Hello, this is Tyler McFeeters with your News Gazette, dated Friday, May 16th, 2025. We'll begin today's reading with the front page story. Out of Champaign County Court, pro-Palestinian protester found guilty of misdemeanor for obstructing police. Story by Luke Taylor. Out of Urbana, a 19-year-old Savoy woman's trial on charges related to her actions at a pro-Palestinian protest at the University of Illinois last year came to a close Thursday with her found guilty of a misdemeanor. Champaign County Judge Robert Weber dismissed felony mob action charges against Yaffa Issa after the state rested its case, saying the evidence falls woefully short of demonstrating that she was involved in any kind of violent activity. Issa was the first individual connected with the protest to go to trial. Weber did not dismiss her misdemeanor charge of arresting or obstructing a peace officer, however, and after hearing closing arguments, ruled it was clear beyond a reasonable doubt that Issa attempted to block officers from accessing tents erected by protesters near the alma mater statue. The trial, which was originally scheduled to carry into this morning, was able to move quickly because Weber had already heard a great deal of relevant evidence when considering a motion filed by Issa's lawyer, Evan Bruno, who sought dismissal of the case on First Amendment grounds. UI Police Captain Jason Bradley testified at the hearing on that motion as well as in Thursday's trial, explaining his involvement in attempts to help UI Facilities and Services employees remove tents from the grounds on April 26, 2024. UI Police Detective Nina Broadnax also testified, saying she had been tasked with investigating incidents related to the protests that day. Specifically, Broadnax said her assignment was to review body cam footage and other videos from the day and find individuals that seemed that their actions were criminal. Broadnax identified Issa through social media by recognizing a distinctive phone case she was holding in footage from April 26th, as well as in her Instagram profile picture. Assistant State's Attorney Eileen Keeley argued that Issa's actions contributed to disturbing the peace, the basis for the mob action charge, despite Bruno's argument that the peace was already disturbed because police moved in through a circle of protesters while trying to make space for facilities and services. Bruno's argument was based on Bradley saying that the protest was entirely peaceful until police formed a wedge formation and approached, at which point they were blocked by a large sign held by demonstrators. Mr. Bruno tries to make it seem like there has to be an instant where, snap, the peace is disturbed. Then anything that comes after that becomes completely excusable, Keeley said. Weber said that the existence of peace to be disturbed was ultimately irrelevant because the charge relied on proving Issa had disturbed the peace by the use of force or violence, which had not been demonstrated. As for the charge of obstructing a police officer, the state needed to prove that Issa knew that Bradley was a peace officer and that she knowingly obstructed him in his official capacity. Bradley and other UI police officers on scene were wearing their uniforms, and he had already spoken to Issa earlier in the day, telling her and others to move the tents they had erected due to university policy. Keeley said a voice audible in social media videos of the incident, calling for people to get in the tents so they could not be moved, was Issa's, though the masks many protesters wore made it more difficult to confirm. Issa could also be seen holding onto the large sign as officers and demonstrators pushed against it and locked arms with other demonstrators, presumably to block access to the tents. Issa will return to court for any post-trial motions and a potential sentencing hearing in July. State's Attorney Julia Reitz said the ruling Judge Weber made matched the pleas already made by two other individuals who were charged in relation to the same incident. Those two pleaded guilty to misdemeanors and saw felony charges dismissed. Reitz also said that the state currently plans to request the same sentence as the one included in the negotiated plea, which is the mandatory minimum sentence for the misdemeanor, 100 hours of public service and 12 months of conditional discharge. The next story is the Champaign School Board. Principal appointees officially confirmed. No action taken yet on superintendent. Story by Jeff D'Alessio, out of Champaign. After weeks of speeches, social media posts, and scrapped agendas, the Unit 4 School Board filled its two principal vacancies, with the in-house candidates district administrators recommended more than a month ago. Cecily Thomas will be the new principal at Booker T. Washington STEM Academy, the school she attended as a child. Cynthia Watson will be the new building leader at Edison Middle School, succeeding reigning regional principal of the year, Angie Schoonover. That leaves just one unanswered question: who will be running the district when the appointments take effect in July? Like on Monday, fourth-year superintendent Sheila Boozer had no speaking role at Thursday's special meeting held at a new location, the Windsor Road Administrative Center. And as was the case earlier this week at the Mellon Building, she was seated away from the board, not in the middle of it like throughout her tenure, which drew the ire of a few public commenters again Thursday. The board hasn't taken any immediate action on Boozer, who has a year left on her contract, other than approving a request for proposals from search firms to help find her successor, who'd take over on July 1, 2026. But between the reduced role, the board meeting in executive session twice this week, her contract allowed it to oust her without cause any time after May 1st, and two new members' public pronouncements that they believed it was time for a change at the top, this week has had the feel of the beginning of the end. Asked about her future Thursday, Boozer told the News Gazette, "I truly care about this district and the community I'm fortunate to be a part of. I'm fully committed to giving my best every single day that I'm here." Thursday's was a brief and drama-free meeting at Unit 4 by Unit 4 standards, with nine community members addressing the board during public comment. After 53 minutes, the board moved into executive session with no action to follow. The promotions were loudly applauded by those on hand, including Thomas's father, the Reverend Hub Burnett, and grandmother, the Reverend Evelyn Burnett Underwood, who are among dozens of community members who criticized members in recent weeks for not acting sooner. Thursday marked the fourth time that the BTW and Edison appointments appeared on the board agenda. The first two times, on April 14th and 28th, the meeting was called off due to a lack of a quorum after half of a deeply divided board, Amy Armstrong, Betsy Holder, and Mark Holm, didn't show up, insisting that it was time for five newly elected members to be sworn in and get to work. That happened last Friday, when an agenda prepared by outgoing President Giannina Baker for the regular meeting that would follow 3 days later was scrapped by successor Tony Bruno. The revised version didn't include the principal positions. Then, at the start of Monday's meeting, Bruno announced that a special session would be added for Thursday for the purpose of filling the district's most talked about vacancies. "It's been a long time coming," Watson said after her appointment was approved. The delay led to frustration from community members who packed the boardroom three times to voice support for the two black women in line for principal posts and chide white members for failing to act sooner. Armstrong and Holder, the lone two holdovers from the old board, said the delay had nothing to do with the appointees and everything to do with the process, particularly in the case of BTW, where a wave of resignations last summer following the departures of popular principal Jamie Roundtree and assistant principal Rebecca Ramey left the elementary with no special education teachers and 20 vacancies building wide, prompting Boozer to issue a district-wide call for volunteers to transfer over. "The delay was never about the candidates," Armstrong said Thursday, "since I did not receive responses to my questions on repeat since last July about BTW, I chose instead to visit the campus again and directly ask teachers, administrators, and staff how they felt and what they wanted. I then had the opportunity to sit with Cecily. I heard her voice, that she has a plan, and it was exactly what I needed. This is exactly what I was looking for, and it gave me all the confidence to vote for Ms. Thomas. Rest assured, I will hold the administration accountable to supporting her in every way needed to serve students." Added Holder, "It is unfortunate that these candidates had to wait and that false narratives were circulating throughout the community. I am committed to integrity in the hiring process, which has degraded over the past year. I am confident in all of these hires and want to make sure that we provide them with the support they need. To quote a community member I recently met with, it is time to pivot and rebuild. First full circle moment, I'm trying not to ugly cry," joked Thomas, who grew emotional after being introduced as BTW's next principal. She called her return to the school she attended as an elementary student a full circle moment that speaks to the power of education, mentorship, and the roots you never forgot. Thomas, who started her career in education as a centennial Spanish teacher and served the high school since 2022 as Dean of Students, then Associate Principal, told her beloved Chargers they'll be missed terribly. She also thanked her whole community for your support on this long journey. "You guys have never not had my back, and I would not be who I am today without your love, care, and support. I am as you are." Watson, Unit 4's Director of School Improvement since 2024, delivered a stirring speech after her appointment became official. "I have listened to so many educators and school leaders say that our children don't want to learn, they cannot learn, and their parents don't care if they learn. I beg to differ," said the 14-year educator, who began her career as a second-grade Teach for America instructor in Indianapolis and holds a doctorate in educational leadership from UI Chicago. At Edison, she said later, "I'm not just here to lead. I'm here to listen, to learn, and to co-create a vision of equity, excellence, and joy." The other front page story is one-on-one with Chancellor Robert Jones. "A generation of inspiring, innovative students who make an impact on our state and the world every day. It's days like Saturday, when thousands of tassels will be turned before beaming family members at Memorial Stadium, that Illinois' outgoing chancellor will miss the most. After 8 years, 7 months, and 21 days on the job, there are so many proud moments that come to mind, and so many people to credit with those successes," says the campus's first African-American chancellor. But for Jones, the one that tops them has to be the 116,211 undergraduate, graduate, and professional degrees we've awarded to Illinois students since September 2016. That's a generation of inspiring, innovative students who make an impact on our state and the world every day. Before the university's 10th chancellor heads to Seattle for his next Big Ten post, president of the University of Washington, Jones has been booked for one last speaking gig. Ahead of his commencement address to the class of 2025 Saturday, editor Jeff D'Alessio asked Jones what he'd say to departing seniors, incoming freshmen, and those interested in his take on a number of higher ed issues. To the UI class of 2025, I say, you found success together while confronting immense challenges, and your Illinois journey doesn't end at graduation. Our shared experiences will bond each of us to the Illinois family for a lifetime. To the thousands of future alumni who've received acceptance letters for the fall of 2025, congratulations, you are holding a ticket to the one of the most profound experiences you could ever have at one of the greatest public universities on earth. To those who say college has become unaffordable, I share your concern, and I have spent the majority of my career trying to develop approaches and strategies that address this question. Since I've been at Illinois, we have more than doubled the investment of our own institutional funds to need-based financial aid programs that serve our students with high need. More than half of our Illinois resident students pay less than $3,000 per semester, and more than half of our undergraduates will leave with no debt. To those who say diversity, equity, and inclusion shouldn't be a part of what we do, it's more important than ever for us to explore what those words really mean. In an education context, they mean that a person's opportunity to achieve a college education should not be dictated by factors like their zip code or the color of their skin. To those who worry about the future of higher education at universities like Illinois due to federal funding cuts, I hope you'll join us in amplifying stories about our positive impact on your lives and families. To those who aren't convinced university research should be reliant on federal grants, public research addresses societal needs that benefit everyone, like health, national security, and our social and economic well-being. Public funding for research has also been shown to have a positive return on investment. Local businesses in Champaign-Urbana, for example, employ more people and benefit every day because of Illinois' research spending. To those who fear that college sports is heading down a path where student athletes are less amateurs and more highly paid employees, this is a historic moment for college sports, and I have full confidence in our Division of Intercollegiate Athletics to continue promoting the development and education of our student athletes while maintaining the storied tradition of Fighting Illini athletics. To alumni on the fence about donating to the DIA's name, image, likeness cause, we appreciate and respect the decision you make, and if you choose to support our student athletes, we thank you for being an important part of our shared success. To those who wonder what an education at a Big Ten university will look like 10 years from now, the modalities may evolve. Illinois is offering more online opportunities and professional certificates than ever, and we expect that trajectory to continue. We have been a leader in developing more collaborative approaches to innovation across disciplines, industries, and borders. We may be bigger, we may be bolder, but the core of what we do, learning, discovery, innovation, and public engagement to benefit all, hasn't changed in 158 years and won't change in the next 10. To my successor as chancellor, at first, you can't realize just how fortunate you are to be a part of this university. In time, you will. Turning now to national and world news. U.S. Supreme Court. A tale of two issues. Justices appear skeptical about both Trump's attempt to reinterpret birthright citizenship and federal district court's ability to order injunctions that have a nationwide effect. Story by David G. Savage of the Los Angeles Times. Out of Washington, the Supreme Court gave a skeptical hearing Thursday to a lawyer for President Donald Trump who was appealing rulings that blocked his plan to deny citizenship to newborns whose parents were in this country illegally or temporarily. None of the justices spoke in favor of Trump's plan to restrict birthright citizenship, and several were openly skeptical. "Every court is ruling against you," said Justice Elena Kagan. "There's not going to be a lot of disagreement on this." If his plan were to take effect, thousands of children will be born and rendered stateless, said Justice Sonia Sotomayor. But Thursday's hearing was devoted to a procedural question raised by the administration. Can a single federal judge issue a nationwide order to block the president's plan? Shortly after Trump issued his executive order to limit birthright citizenship, federal judges in Maryland, Massachusetts, and Washington State declared it unconstitutional and blocked its enforcement nationwide. In response, Trump's lawyers asked the court to rein in the epidemic of nationwide orders handed down by district judges. It's an issue that has divided the court and bedeviled both Democratic and Republican administrations. Trump's lawyers argued that on procedural grounds, the judges overstepped their authority. But it is also procedurally unusual for a president to try to revise the Constitution through an executive order. Thursday's hearing did not appear to yield a consensus on what to do. Justice Brett M. Kavanaugh said the plaintiffs should be required to bring a class action claim if they want to win a broad ruling, but others said this would lead to delays and not solve the problem. Justice Neil M. Gorsuch said he was looking for a way to decide quickly. "How do we get to the merits expeditiously?" he asked. One possibility was to have the court ask for further briefing and perhaps a second hearing to decide the fundamental question. Can Trump, acting on his own, revise the long-standing interpretation of the 14th Amendment? Shortly after the Civil War, the Reconstruction Congress wrote the 14th Amendment, which begins with the words, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside." Prior to that time, Americans were citizens of their states. Moreover, the Supreme Court, in its infamous 1857 Dred Scott decision, said black people were not citizens of their states and could not become citizens even if they were living in a free state. The 14th Amendment established U.S. citizenship as a birthright. The only people not subject to the jurisdiction of the laws of the United States were foreign diplomats and their families, and in the 19th century, Indians who were not taxed and were treated as citizens of their tribal nations. However, Congress changed that rule in 1924 and extended birthright citizenship to Native Americans. Since 1898, the Supreme Court has agreed that birthright citizenship extends to the native-born children of foreign immigrants living in this country. The court said then that the fundamental rule of citizenship by birth, notwithstanding the alienage of parents, had been established by law. The decision affirmed the citizenship of Wong Kim Ark, who was born in 1873 in San Francisco to Chinese parents who were living and working there, but were not U.S. citizens. But several conservative law professors have disputed the notion that the phrase "subject to the jurisdiction of the United States" means simply that people living here are subject to the laws here. Instead, they say it refers more narrowly to people who owe their undivided allegiance to this country. If so, they contend it does not extend broadly to illegal immigrants or students and tourists who are here temporarily. On January 20th, Trump issued an executive order proclaiming the 14th Amendment does not extend citizenship universally to everyone born within the United States. He said it would be U.S. policy to not recognize citizenship for newborns if the child's mother or father was not a United States citizen or lawful permanent resident at the time of said person's birth. Immigrant rights groups sued on behalf of several pregnant women and were joined by 22 states and several cities. Turning now to our communities. Illinois Association of School Administrators. Fishers Thompson recognized as Superintendent of Distinction. Story by Dave Hinton. Out of Springfield. Fisher Superintendent Barb Thompson has been named the 2025 Superintendent of Distinction by her colleagues in the Illini region of the Illinois Association of School Administrators. Thompson was honored at an awards luncheon Thursday in Springfield. State Superintendent Tony Sanders was the featured speaker at the luncheon, where 21 regional superintendents of distinction were recognized. I am deeply honored to receive the Superintendent of Distinction Award, said Thompson, who has been an educator for 30 years and superintendent of the Fisher District for 20 years. It is a testament to the incredible teamwork and dedication of our entire educational community I have been blessed to work with in this incredible district, and I am humbled to be selected by my esteemed colleagues for this award from the Illini Division. Those nominating Thompson noted a number of successes during her tenure, including building an administrative team that is consistently focused on the needs of students and fostering an educational atmosphere where students can thrive and teachers are supported in their efforts to create the best learning experiences. Achieving significant and ongoing progress in updating facilities and grounds to ensure they reflect a dedication to high-quality education. Adding a new junior high wing that has created a more conducive learning environment. Establishing a strategic approach where all administrative initiatives and policies prioritize student success and well-being above all else. The Illini region is composed of Champaign, Coles, Douglas, Edgar, and Vermilion counties. Superintendents of distinction were selected by peers in their region based on their commitment, dedication, and leadership. Effective school leadership requires both vision and the ability to execute, said IASA Executive Director Brent Clark. Barb Thompson has demonstrated both qualities consistently throughout her career in Fisher. Her focus on building community partnerships while enhancing educational opportunities has created lasting positive change for students. The 11th annual luncheon was sponsored by Stifel, the country's leading underwriter of K-12 school bonds. Next story is out of Vermilion County Court. Westville man gets 45 years for killing a friend. Story by Dave Hinton of Danville. A Westville man has been sentenced to 45 years in prison after being convicted of first-degree murder in the January 2023 stabbing death of a friend. Vermilion County Judge Mark Goodwin said Jesse Landers, 44, must serve all of the 45-year sentence and will be required to serve 3 years of mandatory supervised release after he leaves prison. Landers was found guilty after a week-long trial in February. He was sentenced May 8th. The jury heard evidence that on July 3, 2023, officers responded to a report of a man lying in a road. When they arrived, they found the victim, John Carmine, with stab wounds. They said Mr. Carmine was able to identify Landers as the person who stabbed him. Mr. Carmine later succumbed to his wounds. Officers located Landers walking nearby a short time later. During the sentencing hearing, Mr. Carmine's father delivered a victim impact statement, declaring to Landers, "You said John was your friend. You would have given him, he would have given you the shirt off his back." The Illinois Attorney General's Office Criminal Prosecutions Trials Assistance Bureau prosecuted the case along with the Vermilion County State's Attorney's Office. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette, dated Friday, May 16th, 2025. Please stay tuned.